Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, by a narrow margin, the House voted to repeal Obamacare and replace it with their own version of health reform. The revised American Healthcare Act has drawn quite a bit of fire. It's expected to increase premium cost for most consumers, but it's far from a finished piece of legislation. The bill is now in the Senate hands for consideration, and it's expected to undergo some major revisions.
And many in the Senate leadership are publicly stating they are most likely to start from scratch and create their own bill, one that doesn't compromise coverage for so many Americans. Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, is publicly expressing concern over her constituents who may lose coverage or lose protections for pre-existing conditions.
A Republican Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy appeared on late-night comedian Jimmy Kimmel's show, vowing to apply the Kimmel test to any legislation that's crafted in the Senate. Kimmel's newborn son was born recently with a life-threatening heart defect and required immediate surgery and other treatments. He used the experience on his show to promote health care that covers all children, not just those who can afford it. It was very powerful video. If you haven't seen it yet, pull it up.
It was indeed, and unfortunately, one that is all too familiar to individuals who've had a loved one with a medical problem and not had the funds or the coverage to pay for it. So far, we just don't know what the GOP leadership in the Senate is planning to keep intact from the American Health Care Act or what they'll be adding to the legislation. But one thing is for sure, we'll be watching the process with great interest.
Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Daniel Carr, who's the immediate past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine, and also Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
You can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you.
We'll get to that interview in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Senate is getting to work on their version of the replacement for Obamacare, with most in the Senate saying the version of the American Health Care Act sent to them by the House will not survive their review in its current form. The bill would remove Medicaid expansion and protections for the 52 million Americans with a pre-existing condition, leading to what will most certainly be higher rates for older, sicker, and less wealthy people in this country. The GOP measure will allow states to opt out of the pre-existing conditions aspect of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans say there are measures for so-called high-risk pools for those older, sicker folks, but according to analysis in the 35 states that used to have high-risk pools, that is a costlier health plan option for sicker individuals, and it did not work well. Often was underfunded, pricing those sick people out of health coverage. Since this replacement plan is not technically a repeal, it's being handled through budget reconciliation measures that won't require a full 60-vote approval for final passage. Access to health care and economic factors do play a part in overall life expectancy in this country. According to the most recent statistics, the average life expectancy in 2014 was a little over 79.1 years, up more than 5 years since 1980, with life expectancy for women topping off at 81.5 years. But there was little, if any, improvement in life expectancy in some southern counties in states stretching all the way from Oklahoma to West Virginia. Many counties where life expectancy dropped are mostly in Kentucky. However, a baby born in Lakota County, South Dakota, has an even lower life expectancy, about 66 years at last count. The nation of Venezuela's financial woes continue to impact that country's health. Infant and maternal deaths are up dramatically, as are cases of malaria, diphtheria, and Zika. The nation's leftist government has been the target of protests over lack of food and a dramatic drop in basic medical supplies. Infant mortality has risen 30% in 2 years. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Daniel Carr, immediate past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine and professor of public health and medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. He is founding director of Tufts Program in Pain Research, Education, and Policy, the only pain program based in an academic department of public health. A world-renowned expert on pain research and policy, Dr. Carr was the founding editor of Pain Clinical Updates, and he also co-edited the first federal clinical practice guidelines for the treatment of pain. He has held leadership roles in the American Society of Anesthesiologists, the American Pain Society, the FDA, and the National Institutes of Health. He has earned numerous awards and distinctions for his groundbreaking work. Dr. Carr earned his MA and MD from Columbia University. Dr. Carr, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks, Mark. It's my pleasure.
You know, there has been such a long history of healers who have been trying to effectively manage pain management. But if I fast forward to the 20th century and then the 21st, we had this big push in the mid-1990s to make pain the fifth vital sign. And a few years later, the Joint Commission and the Veterans Administration sort of jumped on board with that in an attempt to bring the discipline of pain management into the clinical settings. But I wonder if you could set the frame of reference for our audience about the enormous problems and difficulties that arose in the wake of that action. And what do you think went wrong and why?
Well, Mark, this is a gigantic area, and as I went into the field of pain personally, I had the feeling that it was a field that was a prism not only into all of medicine, but much of human activity. The mechanisms of pain are evident in lower life forms, and it's hard to think of a life form that couldn't adapt to its environment and survive in some way or another. So even if you look at single-celled bacteria, they will actually wiggle around to either be in a less hot or less cold area. So the ability to respond to environmental threat is something that's primordial. And I think ever since the dawn of history, there are very good indicators that people were willing to do things to relieve pain. For example, there was a cadaver recovered during a meltback of the ice pack in the Alps. And that cadaver showed physical signs, tattoos, in areas that were likely painful, owing to the fact that he had arthritis in his low back and neck. And the tattoo distribution followed the distribution of what we would call lumbago or sciatica even today. They probably work to reduce pain, at least temporarily, in the same way that acupuncture does. So since before the dawn of history, people have been doing things and trying everything in the environment to reduce their pain. So that said, I think there's little doubt that right now we're in the middle of a perfect storm. The perfect storm is one in which pain should be treated. People have declared the access to pain treatment as a fundamental human right. And on a worldwide basis, access to pain treatment is a much bigger problem than excessive opioid prescribing on a worldwide basis, but certainly in the U.S., it's a catastrophe of opioid abuse and substance abuse in general. And I would say that there's no family that's been spared some form of substance abuse. And for sure, if you include alcohol, it's an almost universal burden on society. I personally think it's not a bad thing that increased attention has been given to patient comfort. I think that there was excellent documentation in the areas of cancer pain or postoperative pain that the majority of people, before pain was something that was on the medical agenda, didn't have a good experience with regard to pain treatment. Pain was overlooked. A patient's voices were not heard in this respect. So I don't think that a focus upon pain is a bad thing. In fact, the mega trend driving the increasing focus on pain that I would say goes back in the current era to the 70s with the rise of the modern hospice movement and the 80s with the World Health Organization developing a method for pain control, I would say that those mega trends were the results of a shift to patient empowerment in the medical system, where previously there was a tremendous hierarchical organization of medicine and what the doctor said was it, and the patient may or may not speak up. Like many other consumers, patients found their voices being heard more. And among the first things that people are going to ask is, will it hurt, and what are you going to do if it hurts? If you look back over the last 10 or 15 years, just looking at the graphs of availability of opioids to a broad number of people and the consequences of substance use disorder, including death, the curves are very, very striking.
Dr. Carr, I'm going to ask if you can also, for our listeners, maybe think, you know, what the consumer and the patient doesn't necessarily have a good grounding in, and for far too long, is the complex dance that happens between the source of pain and how the brain responds to it. And you've said that recent advances in brain imaging and neurophysiology are giving us a much deeper and a more nuanced, if you will, understanding of the pathology of pain. And this is so important to people's understanding of what this human experience of pain is and what we're going to do about it. Can you describe for our listeners the very types of pain we're talking about and how recent scientific advances are helping us to gain a deeper insight into the nature of pain, which hopefully then leads to better ways to understand, treat it, and manage it?
I'd say that for thousands of years, artists, painters, writers, and so on have chosen suffering as a topic that's expressed in their particular medium. The traditional focus by mainstream medical science was that pain represents the detection of actual or impending injury, but it's incomplete. What's been learned in the last decade or two, thanks to the ability to image people's brains while they're talking with you, while at the same time having their scans show which areas of the brain light up, this really powerful investigative insight has allowed science to integrate the older notion that pain represents the detection of tissue injury with what artists and poets have known for millennia, which is that pain represents suffering, the feeling of isolation or marginalization or abandonment. So one half focuses on mechanisms and detection of injury. The other part of pain has to do with feeling bad, feeling isolated. And if you think about the most common way of relieving pain, in my belief, you can look at mothers comforting toddlers who may have tripped or gotten a scratch or a boo-boo. The mother holds the child, surrounds the child with protection and also touch. And that works in over 99% of the time. You can't overdose from it. So what's happened with the ways of imaging the brain is to rediscover what people knew intuitively about pain, that if they have a very low self-esteem, if they're withdrawing, they have to understand that that's part of the instinctive, hardwired response to having chronic pain. So as their pain is better controlled, they'll be able to reintegrate more. Now, the stuff I've been talking about in the last minute, you can find in ancient writers. Marcus Aurelius, in his Meditations, said pretty much word for word what I just said.
We're speaking today with Dr. Daniel Carr, immediate past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine and professor of public health and community medicine, anesthesiology, and medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. And Dr. Carr, you're a researcher who was credited a couple of decades ago with discovering the pathology of the runner's high, where natural endorphins mask pain for distance runners. You've been thinking critically about the issue of integrated pain management, about the combinations of therapies, mindfulness, physical therapy, yoga, and others. I wonder if you could talk about those benefits.
As I've been thinking about what this whole system does, why does our body have a system for production of opioids on its own, so-called endogenous opioids, without ever having received the drug morphine or another opioid? You have to ask, what are all the functions of this system? When we were studying runners who were placed on an exercise program, we were actually not studying runner's high. What we were actually studying was to better understand why women athletes might have a hard time conceiving a child. And part of that story was that many are very skinny and they lack body fat. And if there aren't enough calories stored up to sustain a healthy pregnancy, a lot of the time the body just shuts off the ability to reproduce. Even if you make sure that women eat enough to maintain their weight as they go on to an exercise program, they still have impaired reproduction. So how could something that is an adaptive system inhibit the ability of people to reproduce? That seems to go against Darwin. But if you look at the system, it has huge social implications. If you give many newborns variety of species, just a tiny sub-analgesic dose of morphine, the cries that they will vocalize when they're removed from the mother cease. If you create knockout mice that don't have receptors for morphine, the mothers of newborn mouse pups will not bond with their newborn. They won't nurse them, and the newborns won't bond with the mother, and they starve, and they die. The males who lack that receptor can't be housed with any other animals because they spend their whole time trying to kill the other animals. And so when you look at the myriad of things that opioids do, I've come to the conclusion that pain relief, while it's important, is not the primary thing. If we're injured, it's well described that the stress of injury gives us a transient analgesia, maybe for a few hours. And so what I've come to look at the opioid system as doing is aligning individual behavior with the needs of the population, so that the wisdom of the population is such that if there aren't enough calories around, if there's a famine or if there's a war, the population will shrink. And even though that seems to go against Darwin, it's actually more adaptive for the population to sustain itself during periods of caloric deprivation. Pain control is certainly a part of it, but there are profound behavioral effects of the opioid system that are not directly related to pain. In addition, the opioids are integral in this aligning of individual motivation and behavior with the population. Because another thing that is very striking is when people are addicted to certain substances like opioids and not to other substances, the things that they will do where an addict may rob from their parent or prostitute themselves, these are very pernicious antisocial behaviors. And I think it's because of a fundamental disruption in the body's motivational system. People will do things that they would just never dream of doing. There's cravings, and then there's another whole level of craving that shrugs aside doing very corrosive things to the social unit.
Well, Dr. Carr, everything that you are speaking to speaks so powerfully to the need for us to reconsider, reform, expand our educational curriculum for training the next generation of healers and healthcare providers. And I'm really intrigued by the learning environment that you've helped develop at Tufts, where I understand pain medicine is also partnered with the public health curriculum. And I think that was the first such program of its kind, a solid educational approach to preparing our future healthcare workforce to better understand and treat pain. And certainly as the opioid crisis remains a front page concern in the United States, more medical schools and nursing schools are taking a greater interest in pain management within their curricula. Can you describe for us your vision of how we support this more comprehensive pain management training?
Well, I can tell you that when we first started the program, which was in the late 90s, people would come up to us and they say, well, why is this in a public health department? Doesn't pain belong in the neuroanatomy or pharmacology department? There's no question that a bottom-up concept of pain where the focus is on nerves that detect heat and cold, but to me that's like studying pigment chemistry if you're trying to understand impressionist art. Like, how does loss of a job or job insecurity drive someone towards substance abuse? You can't even frame that question if your focus is on the single cell or the conduction of a pain impulse. So if you look at the World Health Organization's concept of disease, they have really excellent writings on the social determinants of disease. If there are not enough resources to achieve a clean water supply so that you have parasites in the water endemically, you will see endemic diseases carried by parasites. If you can just invest resources to make pure water available to the population, diseases will go away. Because public health views illness not only as the pathogen or the pathological process, you also have the qualities of the host and the environment. And this needs, I think, to be balanced with a top-down view of the social determinants of disease. There's an awful lot written about the social determinants of addiction. I would urge your readers to Google on the two words rat and park for an innovative way of looking at the features of addiction, the conclusion of that Rat Park story was that if you take mice or rats and put them in a natural environment with other mice and rats and give them things to explore, and it's actually harder to get them addicted to opioids than if you use the traditional testing methods of isolating them in a small cage with no distraction and no escape. And there are a lot of analogies with people.
You know, one of the things that we've been engaged at our Weizmann Institute is hosting pain echoes around the country, because we've recognized that primary care providers want to help manage people who present with pain, but it is a complicated area to do. And we host for clinicians in dozens of states who are interested in the best techniques in terms of managing chronic and complex pain issues that present themselves. I'm wondering, what are some of the best practices that you have identified in terms of helping primary care practitioners manage these problems?
I think that if you are better informed and pay closer attention to the outcomes, you're going to get superior results than if you don't monitor the result as carefully. So applying this to primary care, I understand that primary care providers are very busy. There's a lot of time pressure. But education, first of all, to allow them to understand the alternatives to opioids, and by the way, alternatives to drugs. There are non-drug measures that are very effective for reducing pain by themselves or as a part of a multimodal program. So first is understand what are the options. Second is use patient selection. Predict in advance who is at greater risk to go off the tracks, as it were, versus less risk. And the data is starting to emerge that if you have a carefully selected population and you explore other alternatives, the need for an opioid, at least on a chronic basis, may not even come up. And this is even true of acute postoperative pain or cancer pain. Just knowing what are the available options and tools you can use, how you can screen patients, and then follow the results closely with things like urine drug tests, brings the process from a rushed interaction where it's very easy to write a prescription because it doesn't take much time, to an interaction where you lay out the different options and want to use things with a higher benefit-to-risk ratio first and add on things with progressively lower benefit-to-risk ratios subsequently. If you approach this like any other process, you're going to get better results. But it requires education as to what are the options. It also requires making the options available. If, for instance, a visit with a psychologist to have some training in what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, you've got to make sure that there's a person actually see the patient without delays or insurance denials. So information about what are the options. You need information about whom to select for which treatments so that you're not giving them in a way that ignores individual factors, and you follow them carefully. Data is starting to come out now, which confirms what common sense would say, that if you screen the population, review non-drug as well as drug options, and distribute your therapies among them rather than jumping to an opioid, if there's no benefit from any specific treatment, you don't keep on using it. Common sense would tell you that the outcomes will be better. In fact, in Massachusetts a few years ago, we were asked by Blue Cross Blue Shield to reduce what they felt were some inappropriate prescriptions of pain medicine. One tiny aspect of that whole picture had to do with postoperative pain medicine. And if you look at how long do most people take pain medicine for most operations, it was clear that there were prescriptions given for a longer period of time than the majority of people needed. So just to match up the amount prescribed with the condition and then allow additional prescribing if there was some complication or some exception, but simply not to automatically give what in retrospect was an excessively long duration of therapy, that reduced substantially the inappropriate prescribing of opioids.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Daniel Carr, immediate past president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine and professor of public health and community medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. You can learn more about his work by going to painmed.org or go to medicine.tufts.edu/Daniel Carr. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your insights with us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure, Margaret.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
On May 4th, House Republicans passed the American Healthcare Act to repeal and replace Obamacare. And in the run-up to the vote, politicians made competing claims on whether the bill maintains protections for people with pre-existing medical conditions. The latest version of the bill offers lesser protections than the Affordable Care Act. The GOP bill would allow states to apply for waivers from certain Affordable Care Act requirements for plans sold on the individual market, where those who buy their own insurance get coverage. There are three types of waivers. One allows states to increase how much insurers can charge based on age. Insurers can charge older people up to three times as much as younger people under the ACA, but the GOP bill would increase that to a 5-to-1 ratio. With a waiver, a state could go even higher. A second waiver allows a state to establish its own requirements for essential health benefits. These are benefits that insurers must cover under the law. There are 10 of them under the ACA. And the final waiver, which directly relates to pre-existing conditions, would allow insurers to price policies based on health status in some cases. Such health-based pricing is not allowed under the ACA. If a state received a waiver, individuals buying plans on the individual market who don't have continuous coverage could be charged higher premiums for pre-existing conditions for 1 year. After that, provided there wasn't another 63-day gap, the policyholder would get a new, less expensive premium that was not based on health status. States with such a waiver would have to either have a high-risk pool or participate in a reinsurance program, both designed to help those with high medical costs. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. While more than 20 million Americans have gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act, some 30 million remain uninsured, and many of these are either immigrants or without the resources to purchase coverage. Many more with complex conditions simply can't afford access to specialty care. Entrepreneur Jayanth Komarnani decided to create a virtual way to bypass the system and founded the Human Diagnosis Project, a network of volunteer specialists around the country offering virtual consults for the neediest patients.
The Human Diagnosis Project is an online system built by the world's doctors to understand the best steps to help any patient. We began talking to the world's leading medical stakeholders. We realized that there is an opportunity to develop a system that can ultimately help solve the problem for those people who won't have access to specialty care.
Dr. Shantanu Nundy is director of the Human Diagnosis Project. He's a frontline primary care provider in a safety net clinic who saw the opportunity to provide specialty care in a cost-effective way through volunteer participation from specialists.
The way the system works is safety net providers like myself can freely exchange electronic consultations with volunteer specialists from around the country so that the expertise that those specialists have that our uninsured patients currently can't have access to becomes available.
It's estimated that roughly 35% of specialist visits can be done virtually. The Human Diagnosis Project offers an opportunity to create real savings in the healthcare system while effectively bringing treatment to millions of the most vulnerable.
So there is a very real and large portion of situations in which providing an electronic perspective on that given problem will actually solve that problem for many patients.
A free online portal linking safety net providers serving underserved populations to specialty care expertise, improving outcomes for millions of uninsured and vulnerable patients, and improving care outcomes in the process. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.